This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogay, filling in for Terry Gross. In the past 30 years, new drugs and high-tech treatments such as angiograms, bypass surgery, and angioplasty have cut the death rate from coronary artery disease in the United States by 50%. Still, heart disease kills more than 700,000 people each year. That's more than cancer, strokes, and AIDS combined. Costing some $90 billion healthcare dollars a year, heart disease is a high-stakes specialty. In his new book, Saving the Heart, Stephen Clydman examines the collaboration between heart disease specialists, medical technology entrepreneurs, and drug companies that has given rise to the high-tech cardiology industry, and he suggests that profit motive and conflicts of interest might be adversely affecting patient care. Clydman is a senior research fellow at the Kennedy Institute of Ethics at Georgetown University. He points out that after you've had a heart attack, you have to decide which treatments and procedures will be the best for you. I asked Dr. Clydman if the data is conclusive about which treatments are most effective. If you do your research, whether it's clear which path to take.
No, except in a relatively small number of cases. If your blocked artery is your left main coronary artery, which feeds blood to the left ventricle, which is the main pumping chamber of the heart, then in most cases, surgery is indicated and you get better results in surgery. If you've had three blocked arteries and your left ventricle is not pumping adequately, once again, the chances are pretty good that surgery is your best choice. With many other things, maybe most other things, the best cardiologists, the best surgeons are likely to disagree about what the optimal treatment will be. And there are, even within surgery, are many different kinds of surgical treatments that you can use. So you need to learn a lot, but even when you've learned a lot, you still may end up making your decision based on really non-medical considerations that have to do with your quality of life after the treatment.
In your book, you write about the history of the many high-tech treatments, surgical and non-surgical, that have been developed over the past few decades to treat coronary artery disease. And you look at bypass surgery, which was, I suppose, the first surgical
yes.
technique. And you write that throughout the 70s, there were a number of studies conducted of the value and the effectiveness of bypass surgery that questioned whether it worked or not, or whether it was, as you write, an expensive pain reliever. But at the same time, more and more surgeons were performing bypass. Do you see it, the story of bypass surgery, as a cautionary tale about this and other high-tech interventions, especially in cardiology, that their use and their popularity outrun the research?
It's a cautionary tale with a relatively good outcome. That is to say, bypass surgery was being used hundreds of thousands of times before it was absolutely clear that it was a treatment that would provide a sufficient benefit to warrant the use of such a highly invasive procedure. Over time, after the three big clinical trials that were conducted, I think it's safe to say at this point that in a great many cases, it is the best available treatment. But once again, some of the reasons for that are quality of life reasons as opposed to strictly medical reasons, such as a better mortality outcome. In other words, that you're less likely to die. And there are things like the length of time you can count on having a normal life after the surgery's been performed. Generally speaking, it's a lot longer than with angioplasty, and with the state-of-the-art bypass surgery today, you may get 15, 20 years or more of pain-free, active living. With angioplasty as opposed to bypass surgery, you might find yourself back in the lab 3 to 6 months later having another procedure. This happens in 30% to 40% of the cases. So these are the kinds of choices you might have to make Even when drugs enter into the picture, some people would prefer not to take drugs every day for the rest of their life, so they will opt for surgery. Other people would simply prefer never to have their chest cut open.
So let's talk about weighing the non-surgical options. Angioplasty, first I have to say it has a kind of an amusing history. You write that it was invented by a guy nicknamed Crazy Charlie.
Well, he invented the original technique in the peripheral arteries, not in the coronaries. Crazy Charlie Dotter, who I think probably was called Crazy Charlie mainly by surgeons who were worried that he was going to take away some of their business. He had the unfortunate look of a madman, but I don't think he was really anything but clear-minded and sane.
Now, the technique was perfected or developed in the late 70s, but it took off immediately. Did the clinical results justify its popularity, or is angioplasty a good example of, I suppose, the thesis of your book, that high-tech intervention appeals to surgeons for reasons sometimes that have nothing to do with patient care?
I think it's probably the best example in the book. And I've quoted one very renowned interventional cardiologist to the effect that we probably do 50% more angioplasties a year in the United States than we need to do. Other cardiologists think his number might be a little bit high, but they agree in principle and think it's 25%, 35%. Maybe 100,000 additional angioplasties a year in this country, maybe 250,000 worldwide that really aren't necessary. And there are all kinds of factors driving that. I mean, one is what they call themselves the oculostenotic effect. You see a blockage and you open it, whether there's a clinical reason to do that or not. And there are also, as I mentioned many times in the book, financial reasons for using an interventional treatment. This is something cardiologists can do for which they get a lot of money. If they prescribe drugs, the drug companies get rich. If they send a patient to surgery, the surgeons get rich. This one they can do themselves, and it pays well.
Well, what makes things even more complicated for patients considering options is that there's a whole battalion of differing and techniques and systems for performing some of the new, what they call minimally invasive surgeries. You profile one company called Heartport. They are pioneering a technique of keyhole surgery. What does their story tell us about the way in which market forces influence how heart disease is treated?
Well, I think it's worth looking at two companies at the same time, because they came along right about the same time, and they took on the same challenge in two different ways. And Heartport was one of them. The other one's called Cardiothoracic Systems. Heartport developed a system to treat coronary artery disease through a small incision using a heart-lung machine and stopping the heart while the surgery was being performed, which is the way it's done in traditional bypass surgery, the difference being that you're now operating through a small incision. The other company, Cardiothoracic Systems, developed equipment to do the same kind of operation on a beating heart, not using a heart-lung machine. When they started up in the mid-90s, Heartport was miles ahead. They'd started earlier. They had a large market capitalization, pushing $1 billion, and CTS had to catch up with them. The financial community was placing its bets, and for the most part in the beginning, they were placing their bets on Heartport because they thought the advantages were that using the heart-lung machine, you could manipulate the heart and you could do surgery on arteries on all surfaces of the heart, whereas the beating heart procedure was limited to arteries on the front surface of the heart. You could not manipulate it because it was beating. And so early on, there was a tremendous run-up in the Heartport stock. To make a long story short, we're now roughly 4 years down the road. Heartport has a market capitalization in the range of $50 million. Cardiothoracic systems is probably close to 10 times that at this point, or maybe not quite that much. And it turns out that surgeons simply found the heart port procedure too hard to do. It still probably has a future because it is true that it gives you greater flexibility in performing the surgery. But for the moment, the surgeons that do heart operations, the small number that are doing these keyhole operations, are finding it more comfortable to do it on a beating heart than to try to use a catheter-based system to hook up the patient to a heart-lung machine and to use the very long instruments that were developed to do the surgery through this keyhole incision.
Where does this leave the patient? I suppose this is the story of medicine, this melding of technology, of commerce and science. There's nothing really all that new there. There are always snake oil salesmen, and there are always drug companies peddling drugs to doctors, now directly to consumers. Is your point that that it's a matter of scale with the new high-tech interventions, that commerce is now dangerously tipping the scales away from patient safety or patient consideration more than ever before?
I think it's correct to say that it is tipping the scales in that direction. Whether it is at this point tipping the scales dangerously in that direction or not is a very hard judgment to make. I think that many clinical judgments are being made with a commercial consideration where there, in the past there was none. Surgeons, angioplasty operators have interests in companies. They have interests in specific procedures. They've always had intellectual interests. Now they have financial interests as well. And I think that when such interests enter into a clinical decision, there is a risk that a patient will get an inappropriate treatment. And I think there is a genuine need to be concerned about that. I have to say that some of the best cardiologists I've talked to over the last 3 years are concerned about it. There is talk about it in the community. But at the moment, none of them seem quite sure just how to get a handle on it.
Well, surgeons using these methods, what's the data on their holding stock in the companies or how much they could be or are swayed by financial investment?
The answer to the first question is that some of them do hold stock. The amounts vary dramatically. I recount the story of one interventional cardiologist who had a roughly $10 million stake in a company, and he was also the head of the clinical trial that was testing the device, the principal investigator on the clinical trial that was testing the device. That's about the clearest conflict of interest I've ever seen, and this particular fellow claimed that there are no such things as conflicts of interest. He didn't believe in them. I've talked to numerous surgeons who are using the new keyhole procedures, And at least three that I can think of offhand held small stock positions in the companies. It varies widely. And it's worth noting also that you tend to be talking about some of the very best surgeons who have these interests because they're the ones that the companies are interested in having with them. They're the ones who are innovative and devise these new procedures.
Do you think that these surgeons should be banned from having financial stakes in medical technology? And is that even realistic?
I don't think it's realistic. I think surgeons, physicians, all have a duty, a moral duty, to let their patients know what kinds of conflicts they have. And I suggest in the book that this be done very simply, that they produce a very straightforward form in which they lay out their financial holdings, their financial conflicts of interest. This is not going to put an end to conflict of interest. It's not going to put an end to bias. It's just going to be one more warning for people who are faced with making decisions about treatment. And I think it's a right to know issue.
You said it's a moral obligation. Should there be a policy of full disclosure?
I think there should be. I think the professional societies like the American College of Cardiology, the American Heart Association, which is a different kind of organization, but the major organizations in the field probably ought to take a stand on this issue about disclosure.
Stephen Clydman is my guest. He's a senior research fellow at the Kennedy Institute of Ethics at Georgetown University. His new book is Saving the Heart, about developments in treating coronary artery disease. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is medical journalist Stephen Clydman. His new book about coronary artery disease is called Saving the Heart. Do you also see commercial factors affecting the way in which specialists in cardiology and these other high-tech fields practice, in that they're becoming more focused on the research rather than the clinical work, whether there's a pull towards research and technology development?
One of the things I regret not having done for this book is to try to figure out just what percentage of the community of cardiologists are actually involved in research in any serious way. One thing that is fairly clear is that a lot of the ones who are at the top of the profession are involved in research because it's the researchers who publish in the journals and build their reputations. I'm not convinced that the best researchers are necessarily the best clinicians. I think there's little doubt that there are people with tremendous clinical skills. That is to say, they know how to evaluate a patient. They know how to take a patient's history. They know how to evaluate clinical trial results and apply them to an individual patient. And it's tremendously important to remember that patients are all different. Their disease manifests itself in different ways. And the results of any clinical trial are statistical averages. A good clinician is somebody who figures out how to treat the patient in front of him. There are plenty of physicians like that who do not go anywhere near research. They're just good clinicians. I think it is probably safe to say at this point that the field is being driven by research, by the development of new devices almost day in and day out, and it makes it very hard for non-research-oriented practitioners to keep up with the latest advances. And you are absolutely right that a lot of the high-tech treatment that is done is consumer-driven. That is to say, a patient comes in and says, I've read about this, I want it.
Now, you write that cardiology is the high-tech field. Is the rest of medicine, and you've been covered medical issues for 23 years as a journalist, is the rest of medicine following in cardiology's wake? And do you see a problem with that?
I think that cardiology is, given the size of the field, it's an exception. Cancer treatment, for example, is less device-oriented than cardiology. I mean, high-tech becomes a term of art here. For example, in many areas of medicine now, the cutting-edge research is in genetics. And certainly there's a strong sense in which genetics is high-tech medicine. When you're talking about analyzing the genetic causes of disease, isolating individual genes that influence specific disease processes, you're using very high-tech high-tech technology to carry out these experiments. The difference with cardiology, I think, is that it's actually in treatment that you use these methods. And in an odd sort of way, it's technology, but is it really high tech? I mean, surgery is still surgery, even if you do it through a small incision. Putting a plastic tube into somebody's artery and threading it up into ephemeral artery and threading it up into the coronaries is almost a plumber's technique in a way, you know. So high tech in a way is misleading. I think device driven is probably a better term. You're using an awful lot of hardware in coronary disease, in heart disease, probably more so than in most other areas. Ophthalmology, I mean, there are other fields in which there's sophisticated hardware being used as well. But because of the volume, coronary disease stands out.
Stephen Kleiman, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
Stephen Kleidman's new book is Saving the Heart, The Battle to Conquer Coronary Disease. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.